All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. Our next guest is Adam Morrow, reporter for Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net. Live on the phone from Cairo, Egypt. Welcome back to the show, Adam. How are you?
Good, good, good. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing real good, except all weekend it bothered me that I screwed up the phone number and only had you for 10 minutes. There on Friday, and I really wanted to follow up and learn more about what's going on in Egypt. Doesn't seem to be the topic of too much of the news coverage around here. There's so much else going on. It's sort of getting buried like that story's over, but certainly it's not.
Yeah, the news cycle is really, really speeding up these days. It's really hard to keep on track of what's going on. It's true.
Right.
Natural disasters and governments collapsing, and it's very, very hard. You really have to specialize if you want to understand anything. You really have to sort of choose an area and specialize on it alone.
Right. Well, that's why I have a three-hour show, and I bring all you specialists on to focus on the individual issues at stake. Of course, then there's always Gareth Porter, who knows everything about everything. Okay, so talk to me about the situation there in Egypt. As we were talking about Friday, the military, which is to a great extent the state in Egypt, it hadn't gone anywhere. Mubarak is gone, apparently for now, but it's still an uphill battle and sort of a wait and see how it goes, to see how well the revolution is really implemented after upcoming elections, that kind of thing. But now it looks as though, from the Christian Science Monitor here, the army apparently fired live ammunition into the crowd in Tahrir Square, killed one protester, and pissed off the rest of them pretty bad. You know, what's going on there?
Yeah, it's getting weird. It's getting strange. As you know, ever since the February 11th ouster of Mubarak, there have been regular demonstrations. Demonstrations have continued to be held in Tahrir Square of various size. Sometimes they're larger than others. Last Friday was a big one, and that was basically the demand of protesters in that particular demonstration, which I think their numbers reached in the hundreds of thousands, was for a purge of all remnants of the Mubarak regime. They wanted absolutely everybody who had anything to do with the Mubarak regime, all Mubarak appointees that are still in power somewhere in the government. They want them out. The demonstration also featured a popular trial of Mubarak, where people sort of got together and held a sort of mock trial of Mubarak in which they listed his crimes and called for his prosecution. Now, what happened was apparently people stuck around until about 2 o'clock in the morning, which is officially when the curfew begins. If you remember, through the course of the revolution, there were all of these curfews, starting from, at one point, it was 3 p.m. People had to be off the streets. That curfew has gradually been extended longer and longer and longer, and it currently stands at 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. is the official curfew in Egypt now. And what happened was that during that demonstration, people stayed after the curfew. So shortly after 2 a.m., I hear it was around 2:33 a.m., the army moved in to forcibly disperse the crowd, the people, the several hundred that were still there. And apparently there was the use of live ammunition, although the army continues to deny that any ammunition was, live ammunition was used on protesters. But the upshot was that, one person died. I just heard reports now that it's actually two people were killed. Somebody might have just succumbed to their injuries today. And dozens wounded, as many as 70 people were injured in the melee. But it was very strange, because before this, you had several army officers breaking away from their units and joining the protesters, several hours before all of this happened, which was sort of strange. And from what I understand, the army was going after wanted to arrest those disaffected officers, and those guys were sort of surrounded by and protected by protesters. So it's sort of strange. The information continues to be conflicting, but a lot of people suspect that this is some kind of counter-revolutionary activity, some kind of attempt to maybe drive a wedge between the people and the army, and to maybe turn public opinion against the army. But this is still sort of the subject of debate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I guess, you know, it is a matter of speculation, but you can see how if the if a wedge is made between the people and the army wins, the army's still the army, you know, if it really does come to that. So it won't be like, you know, the people of Egypt get to fire them and all the soldiers join them if it comes down to it, right?
You're absolutely right. And I've had, you know, I've had since the very beginning, if you'll recall, during that sort of tipping point during the revolution, I think it was the final days of January, when you actually had a bunch of officers joining the protesters. They were highly publicized. Protesters were invited up on tanks. I think it was the 28th of January, following the police withdrawal. You had the army come in, and there was this incredible sort of love fest between the people and the army that was, but the media did a lot to promote, where you had these moving scenes of protesters embracing army people and army declarations that they were there to basically protect the people from the police. And ever since then, I've sort of had this feeling that there's sort of this good cop, bad cop sort of method is being employed.
Mm-hmm.
Where you know, with one hand, you'll sort of have the police, the army being portrayed as the protector of the people, et cetera. But at the same time, you also have this sort of harder edge going on. And you had at least two occasions now where the army has actively used force against protesters. There was a similar incident occurred 2 or 3 weeks ago. Maybe it was more like 3 or 4 weeks ago, when you had another Friday protest broken up forcibly by the army, and it's caused a lot of people to question. It's caused a lot of people to question the sincerity of the army when it talks about protecting the people.
Right. All right. Now, okay. So the protests aside for the moment, I wonder what you think your gauge is of the opinion of the protest movement in general about whether they're winning, whether they're making progress, whether things are more or less going ahead on schedule. They're going to have the elections that they want. They're going to have, you know, the degree of internal police force that they're willing to accept and not more than that. Or are they really sort of already pessimistic about the real results of this thing so far? You know what I mean?
Sure, sure. Well, I think as we've spoken about at length in past interviews, and I know with you've spoken to other people in Egypt as well, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, which runs the country now, has delivered on some longstanding demands of the opposition. Several things. Unpopular ministers were sacked. Certain parts of internal security were gotten rid of that were largely seen as being responsible for a lot of the violence that had happened during the revolution have been officially disbanded. But at the same time, a lot of demands still remain. And the belief on the part of the revolutionary movement is that while a lot of great achievements have been accomplished, there's still definitely counter-revolutionary activity being done in order to derail the revolution or to destroy its achievements. There's definitely a sense that this is not over yet, and that there are forces at work that are definitely actively trying to discredit the revolution, whether it be driving wedges between the army and protesters, or whether it be promoting a surge of crime or violence in the streets of some areas, which has happened recently. There's been an upsurge in violent crime in certain areas, with the intention of, you know, portraying this all as an inevitable result of the revolution. Like, they can point to this. It's a form of false flag terrorism, actually, where they can point to this and they can say, look, this is what happens when you remove the, when you remove Mubarak's iron grip on power. You have this inevitable collapse into anarchy. This was a technique that was used heavily during the actual revolution itself.
Yeah.
When the state went so far as to actually release prisoners from jails, with the hope that, you know, with instructions to go out and terrorize the public.
Right.
So
right.
that they can
then
right, well, say,
I'm sorry, we got to hold it right there. We'll be right back with
sure.
Adam Morrow, y'all.
Sure.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm on the line with Adam Morrow from Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net. And now, Adam, before the break, he's in Cairo, by the way. Before the break, we were talking about the various tactics that the regime is using, continuing to use and have used all along to try to divide and conquer the population there. And yet, as you said, the protest last Friday was huge, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. So that's, the silver lining in this entire story, right, is the endurance of the revolutionaries there in Egypt, that they're not giving up. They're staying at this after weeks and weeks and weeks. Every Friday, it's on out there in Tahrir Square. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. People have been waiting for this for 30 years and more. So now that they've got the opening, they're not gonna back down now. And I just wanted to add also about Friday's and what happened in Friday's demonstration is I've also heard reports that that the army was possibly fired on by people within the protesters, not actual protesters themselves, but possible saboteurs that sort of infiltrate into their ranks, and this is a tactic that's we've seen several times. That's becoming increasingly frequent, where you've got saboteurs will get inside of a protest, and then somehow provoke the army, which will then give the army an excuse to return fire on protesters. As you can see, there's a lot of funny business going on right now. There's a lot of deception going on, and there are definitely efforts to cause trouble.
All right. Well, so far it seems like people are staying wise and doing their best to not fall for the trick and react in ways that they're meant to react.
Absolutely. There's definitely a new sense of what maybe political awareness amongst a lot of people. Protesters are definitely, especially the experienced ones, are certainly savvy to these sort of tricks. And when I visited the protest during the revolution, we were searched. I mean, bags were searched. Protesters were very professional about making sure, it wasn't aggressive at all. It was all done very, very politely, but protesters made sure that nobody was entering the Tahrir Square or entering the ranks of entering their ranks with anything that could potentially be used as a weapon or could possibly, derail the peaceful nature of the protests or to give their detractors any excuse to call them violent or to use violence against them.
Right.
Well, good for them, and I hope people can keep their heads on straight about those kinds of things and keep their eye on the prize. It looks like it's working so far. All right, now, your friend Ahmed Alassi, I've interviewed him a few times, and one of the things that he told me was looking positive was that the foreign minister had been fired and replaced with a guy who used to be the transportation minister that even though he had had some scandal in the past and so forth, I think Ahmed was saying that the protest movement was looking on him pretty favorably, or at least hopefully. Now I see that your newest piece here at IPS News is Egypt softens towards Hamas, and I wonder what kind of real change in Egypt's foreign policy has been seen so far, and what you expect for the near term anyway.
Sure. Well, until now, there has been no change in Egyptian foreign policy, but there have been sounds emanating from certain quarters that would lead what might lead the observer to believe that there could be changes in foreign policy. Of course, the top of the agenda of the least popular foreign policy in Egypt probably is the ongoing siege of the Gaza Strip and the closure of the Rafah border crossing with the Gaza Strip to commercial goods. And that's been going on since mid-2007, roughly, when Hamas took over control of the Strip from Fatah, if you recall that.
Yeah, well, I do. That's a whole other discussion about how that all came to pass. But anyway,
that's a very good point. A lot of people, I'll have you know that a lot of people who limit themselves to the mainstream media will have no idea what the true story behind that whole episode was, and that there was actually a lot more to that, and that what Hamas did was actually preemptively. But like you said, that's another story we could get into another time.
Well, you know what? Give me the shorthand there. You opened the can of worms.
Sure. No, it's my pleasure because it's one of these misperceptions that really, really causes a lot of. It's one of the main reasons people don't understand exactly what's going on in Gaza right now. If you see the way it's reported in mainstream media organs, it will inevitably be described as Hamas's bloody takeover of the Gaza Strip from the Palestinian Authority, from the Fatah-led Palestinian Authority, which is very close to the United States. When in fact they did assume control of the Strip, but what is never ever reported is the fact that there was a massive plan. Who was involved? U.S. General Keith Dayton was actually the main player, was the sort of mastermind of this plan, to the point where it's referred to now as the Dayton Plan, and that can be, you can check this out online. Uh-huh. They had hatched this plan basically to move in with Fatah forces and to completely destroy the Hamas leadership, completely destroy it. Also, if you'll recall, Hamas had been democratically elected in 2006 Palestinian legislative elections, and those were actually overseen by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who gave his stamp of approval on those elections.
Well, mandated by George Bush and Condoleezza Rice as well.
Absolutely.
All right, now, pardon me, when you refer to General Dayton's plan, I mean, I know he was in charge of training up the Fatah army in the West Bank, but are you referring to what David Rose wrote about Vanity Fair, about the secret plan to funnel all the weapons to Hamas? Because after all, even after the election, they were going to have to form a coalition government with the PLA in Gaza, and it wasn't until what's reported in that David Rose story, where they had this plan to funnel all these weapons in to the PLA, that they would fight a civil war real quickly and win against Hamas, and all it did was backfire, and Hamas whooped them and took over the whole Strip, didn't have to have a coalition anymore.
Wow, Scott, you've really done your homework. I'm impressed. That's absolutely correct. That story came out in Vanity Fair 7 or 8 months after the fact, though. This Vanity Fair article was significant because it was the only instance in the mainstream media, in the Western mainstream media that I could find that covered that story. But what was also interesting about it is the story didn't come out until 7 or 8 months after the events. So in the mainstream consciousness, it was sort of a blip on the radar screen, that story, and ever since, you hardly hear a peep from any quarter about the actual events that led up to that.
Right. The siege was laid, and there was some rocket fire, but then there was a ceasefire, and they always say that Hamas broke the ceasefire at the end of 2008. And yet,
well, they're doing the exact same thing right now. When they keep, if you look at all of these stories that are coming out, it will constantly stress that anything that Israel does within these last couple of days, during which 19 Palestinians were killed by Israeli tank shells and artillery barrages and airstrikes, they will say that this is all in retaliation for this missile attack that killed somebody on a bus in Israel. When in fact that strike that hit the bus apparently was actually followed an earlier strike by Israel. So Israel will do something, will provoke Hamas into firing rockets, and then they will seize on that, on Hamas's retaliation, and everything subsequent to that will be referred to as Israeli retaliation.
Well, it's always been like that. My whole life it's always been like that.
Well, it started the exchange.
Yeah. No, it's all Israeli actions are a reprisal for something else. It's been like that for 30 years, you know, as far as I know.
And if you know that little key, if you're aware of that, whenever you read mainstream reports, it becomes painfully obvious. And every single time, it's like Israel is never to blame for anything. Absolutely everything it does comes in retaliation for something that had been done to it. Even to the point where if you look at CAF-LED, the way the CAF-LED operation in the winter of 2008-2009, which killed more than 1,400 Gazans over the course of a three-week period, that will inevitably be referred to as having come in response to Gaza, you know, rocket fire from Gaza.
Right, even though it was not Hamas that did it. Hamas immediately killed the guys that did it. And Israel had never abided by their end of the ceasefire, which was to lift the siege in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
All right. Well, anyway, so now how pissed off are the people of Egypt about this? And do they really want change? Is this one of their major goals, is that they've got to lift the blockade?
The anger is definitely tangible, to say the least. People are really upset. They feel the dignity of Egyptians has been impinged upon because of this siege on Gaza, and because the fact that, including CAF-LED and everything that's happened before and since, They've been in a position where they've just had to sit and watch while the Palestinians and particularly the Gazans are abused and murdered on an almost daily or weekly basis, and they've had they've been able to do absolutely nothing. They've just had to sort of sit on their hands because they've been under this police state under Mubarak for so long, which, as you know, is very, very cozy with the United States and by extension Israel. So now that after the 25th January revolution, Mubarak is gone, a lot of these feelings, a lot of this pent-up anger is starting to come out. And what you saw on Friday, one of the things that was unreported largely on Friday, you had what happened in the Tahrir incident, of course, but another thing that happened on Friday was that you had at least 5,000 protesters amassed in front of the Israeli embassy in Cairo, which was really quite something. And they issued a set of demands to the police, or to the army that was there, demanding a halt to all Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip, demanding an immediate lifting of the siege and an opening of the Rafah border crossing, and demanding the immediate departure of the ambassador and the severing of relations with Israel, and most interestingly, demanding that the Camp David peace agreement between Egypt and Israel be put before a national referendum so that people could decide whether or not they wanted to sign on to it. So that was quite something. And very interestingly also, the protesters managed to get right up flush against the building in which the embassy is housed. And that never happened in the days of Mubarak. There were several protests whenever during the Second Intifada and other times. You would have protests. You would have protesters sort of moving towards the embassy building, which is located just on the beginning of a bridge over the Nile. So protesters would sort of march over this bridge towards the embassy, but they would always be stopped by security, and they would never be able to get terribly close to it. This last Friday, by contrast, which was the first actual protest in front of the embassy since the revolution, the protesters got right up against the building. I mean, surrounded the building, and stayed for several hours. I believe some of them might still be there. There might be several people still staging a sit-in there. I have to sort of check the latest facts. But there was definitely activity for 2 or 3 days around the entrance of the embassy.
All right. Now I know that. You went with Ahmed Alassi and with Ken O'Keefe and delivered one sack of concrete to Gaza a few weeks back. But then what is the situation at the Strip right now? Are there any goods and services, much less people, being allowed to cross or no?
I was at the crossing for the last week of March, more or less. And we saw individuals, from what I can understand, we saw lots of individuals going. When I say lots, I mean, maybe dozens, maybe hundreds, not more than that in one day. And these, I believe, are people who either require medical treatment in Egypt or work abroad or study abroad. So in these individual cases, you have Gazans being let in and out of the Strip through the Rafah crossing. However, commercial goods remain banned.
So this is the extent of the softening that the title refers to here.
Well, I wasn't actually that happy with that title, because the story really deals more about Gaza, and it talks towards the end about Hamas specifically. But the main story is about Egypt's approach to the Gaza. It's changing
approach. I was making the statists' mistake in conflating Hamas with the government with the place there.
Yep, it's true. It's true. But that being said, there have also been, you did also have, in the last days of March, you did also have the first Hamas delegation coming to Cairo since the revolution. And saying some quite, after a meeting with the new Egyptian foreign ministry, the Hamas officials did say some quite positive things that sounded like Egypt was in the process of, reconsidering or reassessing its Mubarak era Gaza policies, especially its policies vis-a-vis Hamas. Because if you remember, I mean, as you know, we talked about before, the Dayton plan, you actually had reports. I mean, I don't know, I'm sure these reports are pretty solid, that Egypt, along with Jordan, were funneling lots of arms and as well as training to Fatah right. in advance of this assault on Hamas. My what? Point being that under Mubarak, Egypt was very biased towards Fatah and Mahmoud Abbas and that crowd over in the West Bank, and was actually very antagonistic to Hamas, to the point where, I don't know if you recall, there was this Egyptian-sponsored agreement, it was called the Reconciliation Agreement, that was supposed to basically bridge the gap between Fatah and Hamas and sort of make them play nice again. And that, when Egypt was playing the role of the mediator in that case, they were really very, very obviously biased towards Fatah. And they did everything they could to pressure Hamas into signing on to an agreement that was really not in their interests. And Hamas, to its credit, held out and said absolutely not, and refused to sign on. So it will be very interesting to see how the removal of Mubarak will affect this equilibrium between the Palestinian factions and Israel. I can tell you things are definitely moving. There are things afoot right now that we don't know about going on. You know, there are changes in the balance of power. People are reconsidering their positions right now. But it should be very interesting to watch over the next couple of weeks and months.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you know, with Benjamin Netanyahu in power in Israel, you can pretty much bet that, at least as far as they're concerned, they're going to make sure that nothing gets better for the civilians of, you know, the real victims of their diet, as they call it, that they've been put on in that open-air prison.
Right. Of course not. And, I mean, you even have Israeli officials warning about launching another calf-led operation and things like that. But, you know, quite frankly, I'm not really sure if that's an option for them. I think they're pretty worried about their situation right now, given everything that's going on, given the fact that they just lost Egypt, which was their prize, you know. They had their southern border completely shored up because of this Camp David peace agreement. And they also have this 2004 peace agreement with Jordan, which is the other big confrontation state to their immediate east. And I haven't really been following events in Jordan recently, but I know there have been some serious demonstrations. Haven't heard too much about it lately in the last couple of days. But I know Jordan also was undergoing a wave of popular protests and demonstrations, to the point where I think the king had to replace his prime minister about a month back, maybe more. And now you've also got the situation really seems to be heating up in Syria as well, which although if Syria doesn't have a peace agreement with Israel and it's not a de facto ally of Israel like Jordan and Egypt were or are, but at the same time Syria hasn't been particularly bellicose, and it's called for negotiations over the Golan Heights and things like this. But if all three of those countries were to suddenly be in the position where they were calling the shots and deciding their own fates and deciding what international treaties they would and would not, you know, adhere to, I think the situation could get very uncomfortable for Israel.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, you know what, back to the revolution, as long as I'm keeping you over time here, I wanted to ask you about the torture documents. I know there was a lot of purging and burning and shredding of documents, and yet also read and actually saw some pictures of where the protesters, the revolutionaries, had gone into the Interior Ministry and seized a bunch of papers and got them out of there, I believe, put some of them online. And I just wonder, you know, to what degree is the old torture ministry going to be allowed to get away with it? I know they were kind of renamed something else. Was it really just a renaming, or are they really replacing the old National Police Force with something else?
I'm really not sure. Are you talking about the Interior Ministry in particular? Because I know that the minister himself is in jail, and there's a lot of pressure to
Omar Suleiman. He's in jail? Wasn't he the boss?
Not Omar. Omar Suleiman was the head of intelligence, was head of general intelligence.
Oh, I see.
And that's actually a good point. The fact that I have not heard anything about him being prosecuted. That's a really good. He was actually in charge of the whole Palestine file, and was famous for his antagonism towards Hamas. I don't know if you remember the Palestine papers that got leaked.
A couple months ago.
Because they were absolutely damning in terms of Suleiman. I mean, I think he was quoted at one. Suleiman was actually quoted at one point as saying that he would welcome an Israeli reinvasion of the Sinai Peninsula in order to come in and stop weapon smuggling, which is just treasonous.
Wow. Well, no wonder he's Obama's guy.
Exactly.
Has there been any word in that? Have they given up on him? Are they? The whole country must be crawling with CIA. Do they have a list of runner-up nominees here?
Oh yeah, no, I agree. I think I think there's a lot of foreign presence in Egypt right now. I think people are extremely active right now, because it's the importance of Egypt, and this is something we've talked about before as well. But it's, you really can't compare Egypt geostrategically to Tunis, or to Tunisia rather. Tunisia, you know, Tunisia was lost, and I'm sure the powers that be said, you know, oh well, you know, we can fix that later. But Egypt, with its 80 million strong population and its geographic, you know, its strategic location, right between Asia and Africa, and its Suez Canal, I mean, these are just prizes that are too dear to give up easily. So I'm sure there's a lot of foreign espionage going on inside the country. Absolutely.
All right. Well, listen, I really appreciate your time on the show, especially staying overtime with me here and being available for me to get some good reporting right out of Egypt for the people here.
Sure, sure. And just in general, I'm doing my best, like we talked about before, about this ridiculous news cycle, you know. I'm doing my best to sort of, you know, keep my finger on everything that's going on, but at the same time, there's so much happening. So I'm generally looking at foreign policy stuff more than I am, the nuts and bolts of, like, the domestic stuff that's going on right now. For example, you know, you have a lot of people that are facing prosecution right now, a lot of elements of the old regime. Mubarak just came on television, did a television interview yesterday denying that he had all of this money hid away abroad and things like that. I'm not really following the sort of ins and outs of the particular ministers and the particular officials that are, you know, their trials. Although the public at large, needless to say, the public at large is following that very closely, just because it's so interesting. But generally speaking, I'm sort of looking at the future more than the prosecution of these corrupt officials. So just that's sort of where my expertise is. It's sort of, you know, foreign policy.
Well, obviously.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, I mean, hell, the situation is, I don't want to learn the name of every politician in Egypt. I shouldn't have to anyway. I mean, that's the whole point is, you know, my government's an empire is kind of making it my business. But I'm more interested in the broader questions, like, do the people in Tahrir Square, you know, like I was asking you, do they feel like they're kind of winning? How uphill of a battle is it? How much is the military acquiescing? How much are they fighting back? You know, in those kinds of terms, and you can definitely answer those. But, foreign policy,
sure.
And Egypt's relationship with the rest of the world is obviously the most important part to me as well.
Right, right. Yeah, no, but public opinion stuff is also extremely important, because that's the stuff where the, you know, the mainstream media will often try to distort, you know, the way people
actually
believe.
I figure if the people in Tahrir Square pretty obviously think, yeah, right, every time they're told something, then I'm with them. You know what I mean? I trust their judgment on that kind of thing, or whether they're, how angry they are, or how proud they are that things are continuing to go their way or whatever. I think that's a pretty significant gauge, you know, without having to break down all the nuts and bolts of who's been changed from which office, you know?
Sure, sure, sure. Although, just very quickly, sort of revolutionary opinion isn't as monolithic as it used to be. You know, during the days of the revolution, it was extremely unified. You know, everybody had the exact same demands. Since then, cracks are appearing. I mean, as you would expect.
Sure.
Right. As sort of different groups sort of start calling for different things, and that could be seen in the referendum. That's what we saw in the referendum 2 weeks ago.
Right. Well, do you want to elaborate about that? We talked about that a little bit on Friday.
Sure.
It's the sectarian difference was what caught my ear and made me cringe.
Right, right. Well, I mean, there is a sectarian difference. What's interesting is nobody ever really talked about Article 2 of the Constitution. Article 2 wasn't one of the articles that was coming up for amendments. But what Article 2 is extremely important, because Article 2 basically stipulates that Egypt is an Islamic country, and its laws are based on Islamic law, okay? Loosely based on, you know, will sort of more or less reflect the values of Islamic law. And basically, the fear was amongst many, and of course, many Muslims support that. Egypt is roughly 90% Muslim, and so that's how probably the vast majority of the population wants to keep it. Now, a no vote would have meant no amendments. Instead, we want a whole brand new constitution written from scratch. Okay, and word sort of got out amongst many Muslims, amongst the Muslim majority, that look, if this thing goes down and they vote and we vote no and they scrap the constitution and they rewrite one from the very beginning, it's not going to include that second article, and we're going to end up with this completely secularized constitution, governance devoid of any kind of reference to Islamic values. And that's what mobilized a lot of Muslims to go out and vote and say, we vote yes, we accept these amendments, which will basically liberalize the political, the electoral process. But aside from those 8 or 9 amendments, we are going to keep the current constitution intact, which ensures us that Egypt will remain, will maintain its Islamic character. And its laws and its rules and regulations will be loosely based on Islamic law and values.
Well, and how problematic is the rest of the Constitution in terms of the form? I mean, obviously the place is pretty much a military dictatorship one way or the other, but is that really represented in the Constitution itself? Would scrapping it and starting it over really be an improvement, or could you change what you have now to a parliament or something?
I think people know that they are going to get elections. They're going to get parliamentary and presidential elections later this year. So I think the idea is, why don't we elect the people who are going to basically represent us to rule the country, and then once we have that majority in, we can do whatever we want at our leisure. If we want to do more amendments in the future, we can. But we'll be represented. We'll be represented by the parliamentarians and the president that we put in, that we elected.
All right, well, don't you believe in no Barack Obamas over there, people?
Oh, yeah, well, I'll tell you.
Hope and change. Be suspicious of that when they promise,
Believe me, I am, Scott.
The sweeter the song.
I think Mohamed Baradei, I see sort of as the Obama of the of Egypt, actually. And I've been saying that for quite a long time now, because he's been talking about a presidential run for more than a year now. And when he first appeared, it was all change, change, change. I mean, it sounded like he had just taken a page from the Obama campaign playbook.
Well, I just like him for stopping the war with Iran over and over and over again, but I don't know anything else about him, really.
Well, I mean, it's people need to sort of look into his background and see the role he played about Iraq and the weapons inspections that happened over there, because he really, I think he played a very negative role in terms of allowing what happened with Iraq to happen. And I think more and more people are starting to say that. And I don't think he doesn't have any real popularity on the street at all. He's seen very much as someone imposed from the outside. He's lived most of his life, I think, abroad.
Imposed by who on the outside? People think he works for the Americans? Do you think that?
I wouldn't entirely rule it out as a possibility, quite frankly. I mean, when you look at some of his political associations and the think tanks that he has associations with.
Oh, yeah? Like who? Brookings and CFR and them?
Oh, let's see. There's actually I think there's a PNAC connection.
No. To Mohamed El Baradei?
He's definitely a board member of the crisis group, right?
Oh no!
Oh yeah, that's for sure. He's definitely associated with the crisis group, and the crisis group.
What a strange world I live in here. How did I get stuck here?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of these people that are being sort of touted as, these forward-thinking, technocratic, practical, Western educated guys who look sort of so good at a first glance, man. If you check out their backgrounds, they raise a lot of questions. Man. And plus,
does have some real good deeds under his belt, though.
But if you were a potential candidate like this, I mean, wouldn't you just rail about the Israel-Palestine problem and the Gaza siege? And you've heard nothing like that emanating from him. I mean, I think that this guy would be like, hey, if I'm elected president, I'm going to open that border so these 2 million people can have food and cement and da da da.
Well, that silence really speaks volumes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's just like the silence, the Obama silence. I mean, the guy had just become president of the U.S., and cast lead had just happened, and not a word. I mean, literally not a word from the guy after 1,400 people had just been burnt alive by white phosphorus. The guy doesn't say anything. And then has the nerve to go on to talk about, you know, human rights and bringing democracy to the Middle East and all of this stuff. I mean, it's so transparent.
Yeah, well, you know, yesterday, the Chinese released a report in response to the CIA's State Department country report on their human rights abuses, slapping the American Empire right back. And I got to admit, you know, just because I'm from here, I don't know how you feel about it, but that stings, man. I don't like having the Chinese being able to credibly accuse my government of being hypocrites on that.
So let me get this straight. So basically, the Chinese issued a report on human rights abuses by the United States.
Right. Yeah, I know part of it was about the civilian deaths in Iraq. Just relying on the WikiLeaks, the Chinese report says 63% of the people killed in the Iraq war were civilians. And that's, of course, with the very low ball 100,000 count there compiled. There was more to it than that. They had, I'm trying to find my correct link here. But anyway, you can find it however you pronounce it that begins with the X over there.
Oh, Xinhua, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so I got to tell you, Adam, I really appreciate your time on the show and appreciate knowing I got a source right there in Cairo who's keeping up with events, especially in terms of Egypt's relationship with America and Israel, et cetera. So,
sure, Scott. My pleasure.
So, you know, be warned. I'll be turning to you again soon.
All right. Ahlan wa sahlan, as they say here. Anytime.
All right. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks, Scott. Thanks. Take care.
All right, everybody. That is Adam Morrow. He's a reporter for Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net. And we've been featuring more and more of them at antiwar.com as well.